Good evening and welcome to the All Souls Forum. Tonight's speaker is Paul Johnson on crunch time in Kansas politics. Paul is a lobbyist for the Kansas Rural Center, specializing in legislative and budgetary issues as they relate to agriculture, water, the environment, rural populations, and energy. This talk was recorded on November 1st, 2015, at the All Souls UU Church in Kansas City. Unfortunately, the recording missed the first 5 minutes or so of the talk. However, Mr. Johnson was gracious enough to phone in the missing part of the talk to KKFI's studio on November 4th.
Thank you for this opportunity to share some observations on the conservatives' political chaos going on at the state capitol in Topeka. Since 1980, I've been one of those damn lobbyists. I was hired by a coalition of churches to monitor, advocate, and report on certain poverty programs. I've also done some research and advocacy on weatherization, energy conservation, affordable housing, and a family farm agenda. Today, I'm lobbying for the Kansas Rural Center on water, the environment, agriculture, and local food issues. Also in 1980, I bought my 40-acre farm in southern Jefferson County, not far from Lake Perry. I started market gardening in 1985 and was a founding gardener member in the Rolling Prairie Farmers Alliance, CSA, which is a vegetable subscription service. Rolling Prairie is the oldest multi-farm CSA in the Midwest. We have 5 distribution sites with over 300 subscriptions. 2 are in Kansas City. 1 is at Johnson County Community College, and 1 is at Roland Park Community Center on Wednesday nights. And we just finished our 21st season. So we're always looking for more subscribers for next year, and our website is rollingprairie.net. In terms of Kansas state politics, you may have heard the phrase March to Zero, which applies to the elimination of the income tax in Kansas. I think the impact will be much, much broader, more like a march to Mississippi, a state with greater income inequality, underfunded public schools, second-class universities, a shredded social safety net, inadequate public safety services, and deteriorating highways. And I don't think the politics of this are very surprising. The super rich, along with the Koch brothers, have started turning our elections into auctions. Their plan is to downsize government so they can write the rules and regulations and new tax laws. Governor Brownback has led this charge, might I say, with sage advice from Arthur Laffer. What a great name for a snake oil salesman, economist, consultant that we paid $75,000 to listen to. Thought was that Kansas should emulate 10 other states in our country that have no income taxes. But if you look at those states, like Florida, incredible tourism, Wyoming, coal, Alaska and Texas, incredible oil revenue, I mean, Kansas is a different breed here. Historically, Kansas rebalanced our revenue sources in 1992. Prior to that, we had unequal property taxes for schools and much unequal funding across the state. So what happened in 1992 is Kansas raised the income taxes and it raised the sales taxes so that it could lower some of the property taxes in various districts. The ideal was that we would have one-third income tax, one-third sales tax, and one-third property tax. Now, it's important to note that income/sales taxes funds statewide government, while property and some sales tax is the funding base for cities and counties. So as we continue to cut the income tax, there's a much greater impact on state services. We did not get a true one-third, one-third, one-third balance, but we came pretty close. Income tax has been in the 28 to 30% level. But we couldn't leave good enough alone. We started cutting taxes under Bill Graves in the late 1990s with the expansion of the tech bubble. But Kansas did create a refundable earned income tax credit for working families, which, by the way, Governor Brownback proposed eliminating in his first tax plan. And we started reducing the estate tax or the inheritance tax. And by now, we have completely eliminated it. It's been the highest priority for a lot of our farm lobby, from the Farm Bureau to the Kansas Livestock Association, on our way to creating an agricultural aristocracy. Now, Governor Sebelius also cut taxes by reducing property taxes on business machinery. And there were promises made with these cuts that we would cover the losses to cities and counties since they rely so much more on property tax. And we did that for a little while, but that died with the recession and the budget deficits. Governor Brownback was elected in 2010, and he starts the path to completely eliminating income taxes. Now, it's important to know that the vast majority of income tax are from individuals. Corporate income taxes have been declining for several years. And those listeners of Jim Hightower have heard his reporting on the evasion of paying taxes by corporations. Do you think that now that corporations are considered persons as designated by our grand United States Supreme Court, that they may be forced to pay a fair share of the taxes? I guess I'm not holding my breath.
So far, we had three brackets for individual income taxes. So we've eliminated the top bracket, and we started lowering the other two brackets. It's a cost of about $800 million a year to Kansas at this point, and still growing. That's about 70% was changing the brackets. The other 30% had to do with a novel idea, first in Kansas, I don't think it's been done across the thing, is to eliminate income taxes on business income. So if you're filing as a limited liability corporation, a sole proprietorship, subchapter S, that was eliminated immediately. Now, the data that was done in 2009 to say, well, how much is it going to cost us and who can apply for it, showed that there were about 192,000 filers in Kansas. That's out of 1.4 million filers, so about 14% of the filers had this business income. The estimate was it would cost us $160 million a year to do that. Well, we've got some updated data now from 2013. We've gone from 192,000, these businesses, to 333,000 at this point. And of those 333,000 filers, about 5%, just at 17,000, their business income starts at 100,000 and goes into the millions. And when you run the numbers, and now the cost of this went from 160 million, we initially thought, now we're at 210 million, and it continues to climb. So those 17,000 filers, 100,000 income and above to infinity almost, they get 83% of the breaks of this $210 million. So when the governor says, this is a small business, we're helping small businesses in the Kansas, I'm not sure that's quite true. Actually, there are 2,700 of the 17,000, I know there's a lot of figures, but I'm trying to stay with this. Of those 17,000, 2,700 started half a million and go, we don't know how high it goes. They get $87 million. The governor was reelected in 2014. $30 million of dark money was spent to get this governor reelected. I'm sure you people didn't miss the strip club ads for Paul Davis. It was broadcast, you know, paid for. I mean, it's a great investment by the super rich and the Koch brothers to put up $30 million to get tens of millions of dollars in income taxes yearly that's going to go on until it gets changed at this point. And how do we solve the hole that was created with some of this income tax? We raise the sales tax. It's the most regressive tax of the three taxes that we have. So working people get to pay what the Koch brothers aren't paying at this point. Kansas now has the second highest sales tax on food, groceries, in the country. And guess what? We're only second to Mississippi at this point. When it's about 15% of our sales tax comes off groceries, and that's just groceries. If you think about restaurants, you think about takeouts, the sales tax, about 25% is groceries and takeout. So we had a budget crisis, starting with the Great Recession that hit Kansas, and it hit it pretty hard. We dropped about 10% in state revenue in 2009. So Governor Sebelius and then Mark Parkinson had few choices but to really get after, making cuts. Kansas cannot deficit spend, no states can. So you've got to figure out how to balance budgets at that point. And Sebelius had a few benefits because there are certain one-time cuts and one-time budget gimmicks that you can make. We had a $400 million ending balance. You can spend that down once to $50 million, to take that to help with. So we were already on a decline, and then Governor Brownback's elected, and he's intent on finding ways to pay for future income tax cuts. So arbitrary 10% across the board cuts are made in Kansas. I think we've stopped counting whether we have enough state employees to do what needs to get done, whether we have enough social workers out there to monitor child abuse cases, whether we have enough people to look at the CAFOs in our state and what it's doing to water quality. But it was in 2010 that the conservatives really took over the Kansas House, per se, and ran. 20 Democrats were defeated, and the imbalance started there. And then 2012 was when more dark money came into Kansas, and it basically ran the Republican moderates out of the state Senate to turn it extremely conservative at this point. And the legislatures doubled down on these budget cuts, and they've passed a rule that's called PAYGO, and really what it says is if you want to add money to a budget, you've got to find another budget to take it from. That you can't add new revenues, can't raise taxes. It's zero. You got to steal from one other agency if you can to get to your early childhood or to get whatever that you're pushing for. But we don't have such a rule for tax cuts. Nobody has to find out how we're going to pay for when we reduce the revenues. So, and the other way they further doubled down with these tax plans and what it's doing to the budget in Kansas is that now any revenue increase over the next few years, from one year to the next, that goes up over 2%, any new money above that 2% has to be plowed back into further elimination of income taxes in our state. So the budget cuts that we've had for 5 years running, and the number of state employees we've lost, the lack of funding for schools, probably that 2% is not going to do it. Because that 2% is probably going to be eaten up usually by medical inflation. And that's happening to everybody, and that will take, so we're locking in some real problems with state agencies to be able to handle their obligations. So where do we spend the money in Kansas? And this probably isn't very complicated per se. Half of our state budget goes for K through 12 spending. And I could spend all the time I've got up here just talking about K through 12 spending and issues. But in 2008, right before the recession, from the state spending level, we hit about $4,480 per student in Kansas. Today, in 2015, it's down $600, almost 15%, to $3,852. And really, I was looking at a number from Dale Dennis, who's kind of the guru from the State Department of Education. His data shows that when we built the new school funding formula in 1992, if we were going to keep that level spent, you know, adjusted for inflation from 1992 to 2015, we should be at $6,000 instead of $3,852 at this point. And we have it locked in until 2017. Now, the Kansas public school system ranks somewhere around 10th in terms of quality, in terms of outcomes, we do exceedingly well. And the nine states that do have better performances spend quite a bit more money than we do in Kansas. So now the questions are, will the Kansas Supreme Court force this debate at this point? There are a couple lawsuits sitting on their docket, whether it's going to force the legislature to pony up more money. This happened in 2006 that Sebelius had to deal with when $400 million was ordered by the courts at this point. But that case comes up next year, 2016. A key election year. Everybody's looking at the options and angles at this point. Kansas has 286 school districts, and when you divide it out, it's about 550 students per school district. Now, you've got your large ones, the Olathe and the Wichitas and Kansas City, Kansases, Shawnee Missions, etc. But the last time we reduced the number of school districts in Kansas was in the 1960s. We took it down from 1,000 to 300. Now it's 286. And it was a political bloodbath. People still remember the problems that representatives and senators had to vote for that. So everybody promises that we're not going to have mandatory consolidation of these school districts. But I think what we are going to have is we're just kind of bleed these school districts until they have few choices to be able to pay the bills. And the question is, will in 2016, right now we're in a two-year block grant, it's locked this in. Now the question 216, are we going to have any kind of significant debate about rebuilding a new school funding formula in Kansas? And if I were a betting man in election year, I would be doubtful at this point. So that's 50% of the state budget. Another 12% goes for higher education, universities, community colleges, technical schools. And really, Kansas is kind of in the middle when you compare the 50 states on the level of state support that we're giving to higher education right now. But there are worried people about what the future holds in Kansas. The president of Kansas State University has gone on record saying that he's doubtful in 10, 12 years that there'll be much of any state support at this from Topeka. And when you look over the past 10 years in Kansas, tuition rates at higher education has gone up 60%, and our state funding, state revenues that go to university has dropped 6%. Tuition up 60%, state support down 6%. You know, the governor talks about this being a real laboratory, that he wants Kansas to be the red state that has the novel tax and budget reforms, you know. I'm starting to wonder whether this rat is gonna die before we get through some of these experiments. I believe I'm right on this, that Kansas is one of only six or eight states in the country that still has a state-owned flagship medical hospital, like the University of Kansas Hospital. I guess I wonder, what could that bring on the market if we're ready to sell that for to help pay the bills in Kansas. So that's education, that's 62%. The next 25% is social services. So that totals 87% of the budget in those three items. And really, when you look at social services, the key thing you have to remember is that 90% of the spending is on Medicaid, and it's on our state mental and hospitals for the mentally ill and for the disabled. So we privatized our Medicaid program 2 years ago. It's called CanCare. Three insurance companies bid for contracts. We call them medical care organizations, MCOs is the term used. And the first 2 years that these MCOs have had these contracts, they've lost tens of millions of dollars. So the question is, how well is this going to work going forward? And it's almost impossible for an individual to file a complaint or to get, you know, some kind of ombudsman, you know, to look at how the services you're getting or the quality at this point. The first ombudsman picked by the governor was inadequate and inept and was quickly fired. So our Medicaid program, CanCare, serves 420,000 residents in our state out of 2.9 million people. It's half of all the nursing home clients in the state of Kansas funded by CanCare. And it funds 40% of all the live births in Kansas. We have about 38,000 births in Kansas a year. This conservative legislature said we are not going to have a debate on expanding Medicaid in Kansas, and we haven't. Same story that I see in Missouri at this point. Estimates are that there are about 330,000 Kansans that are uninsured at this point, and that 150,000 of them would be picked up by an expansion of Medicaid at this point. A thing happened a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago. A small hospital in Independence, Kansas closed. And rural hospitals are on the cutting edge of how they're going to make it. And they're on the cutting edge, given there's some Medicare reductions, some other things going on, that the uncompensated care that they were counting on is being reduced because federal government thought Medicaid was going to be expanded. The thing about Independence is that their state senator is a man named Jeff King, happens to be vice president of the state Senate. And suddenly he's saying maybe we need to relook at the debate on whether we expand Medicaid. It's sad that it's going to have to come to watching small communities lose their basic health services to get that debate going. On mental health issues, Kansas has about 20, they have 27 community mental health centers across the state. There was a lot of hope that as we closed the state mental hospitals, which we did in Topeka, that money would be transferred that they could hold on to that money at the community level. And there's real questions and debate on whether that really did happen at this point. We have a state law in Kansas that says you have to serve the community mental health centers have to serve every client, whether they're insured, whether they can pay, they're mandated to do it. And in the past, we had a general grant that came out of the state capitol to help these mental health centers cover some of the uninsured. Well, with budget deficits, they've continued to decline, and it's continuing to decline. Medicaid expansion would make a big difference in providing mental health centers, mental health services in Kansas, but we haven't seemed to do that. You know, it's kind of, now we're dropping them to the county jails. You know, Johnson County, I've been told, is one of the largest holder of mentally ill people in our state at this point. So, on to the court battles, and these are great. And Missouri plays a wonderful role in this, in a fashion. In the early 1960s, the governor of Kansas resigned the day before his term was up so that his lieutenant governor could appoint him to the Kansas Supreme Court. And Kansans took that somewhat personally, and they passed a constitutional amendment in 1966. Basically, to streamline, you know, we have 31 districts, court districts across the state. So this constitutional amendment did that. It also said the Kansas Supreme Court would be the body that regulates these district courts and appoints chief judges, etc. And it also set up a nominating commission for who would recommend names to the governor to be put on the Supreme Court. And if I have my history right, I think this is where this came out of Missouri, that they, I don't know if it was first, but that's what it's been called, the plan for selecting Supreme Court justices. Well, our governor, you know, has taken over the legislature now. He has the governor's office. So it's time to figure out what's the political leverage that they have with the courts. So they've gotten very clever in Kansas, and I think this is a first across the nation. We like to be first when we can be. Our legislature is passing budgets for the court, and with it comes certain policy changes. So if you want your money to fund the courts to keep those open, then you have to swallow these policy changes. And that got at who picks the district judges, how do they handle their budgets, et cetera. And then to double down on that, the legislature put a clause in this budget slash policy bill that said, and if the courts overturn any of these policy changes, we are rescinding your budget. Wow. The Kansas Supreme Court's going to look at this in December, by December 31st. There's already four judges have already filed suits. They've already gotten a preliminary decision saying that that's a real constitutional question. So here comes the battle over the courts. The governor wants to appoint the justices, or he wants them elected. That's been his mantra since he started. Kansas has a Court of Appeals, which is the main court right under the Supreme Court. It was set up in the 1966 constitutional amendment is in the Constitution. The establishment of the Court of Appeals was done by statute. So Brownback was capable with conservatives to step in and do away with the nominating process for the Court of Appeals. And now he gets to choose what he wants, and then the Senate confirms it. They want to do it with the Supreme Court, but they have to change the Constitution to do it. It takes 84 votes and 125 members of the Kansas House. They've passed it out of the Senate, but they can't get to 84 votes in the Kansas House at this point. But I would say that the conservatives may have the last laugh in all of this. Supreme Court justices have to go up for a vote ever so often for retention elections to keep them on the thing. There were two judges on the ballot in 2014 when Brownback ran. They won their approvals by 52-48%. So five of the seven members of the Kansas Supreme Court will come up in 2016 for a vote. I'm going to jump ahead to a few other issues and then take some questions here. On the utility front in Kansas, I think people, the advocates and Sierra Club and folks ought to, you know, take a victory lap for holding off an expansion of coal plant at Holcomb out in western Kansas, and they held that on thing. They got a renewable portfolio standard passed so that we would start hitting a certain percentage of the electricity generated in Kansas by renewable energies, and we've met that at this point. 2001, we had one wind farm in Kansas. Today, we're almost at 20. 20% of the installed electricity generation in Kansas is now renewable, wind-based. So progress does happen. Things are moving in parts of this thing. What we haven't seen, unfortunately, is on a community wind basis and smaller wind systems and that for schools and that. And a lot of that gets into a question about net metering. And it gets into a question, what's a fair rate? If you're producing extra power in your solar panels on your house and selling it back to the utility, what's a fair rate that you should get for that electricity? And then secondly, since you're hooked up to the grid, since you don't have your own battery system that you're using as a backup, what's a fair customer charge to charge people who are generating their own power? And that's now sitting before Westar brought in some odious recommendations to really hurt solar producers, and the Corporation Commission disallowed that in this recent rate case, and are going to spend a year looking in a docket at how we come up with fair metering and customer charges. I mean, you know, the bigger picture is that Kansas City Power and Light and Westar and Kansas Gas Service and, you know, the biggest players in the utility field are natural monopolies, and they're given certain service areas, and they always come to the Corporation Commission with a request of a rate of return of 9 to 10% for their equity holders. Gee, who doesn't want 9 or 10% on equity in a time when it's zero interest rates at the Federal Reserve and you're getting 1% on your CD? But being that said, what Kansas needs to do is look back and, you know, and really integrate energy conservation and efficiency options into our utility systems. Kansas has been about 45th out of the 50 states of having energy conservation programs or utility programs. Kansas City Power and Light has $60-70 million worth of those programs on the Missouri side, and they got a bill through our legislature that's going to change how the Kansas Corporation Commission can rate base some of these investments. So maybe the light's starting to turn on in Kansas. What we don't have in Kansas is a really full-scale integrated resource plan, and by that I mean we really don't understand how well we use energy in our state. We have 1.2 million houses in our state, and we don't have a clue how many of those are fully insulated and new windows, etc. And a third of those at that 1.2 million houses are rentals. And we have never struggled with the renter pays the utility bill, landlord owns the property, how do we integrate getting, you know, and hey, there's Midwest Energy and Hayes has done some of that. On to the environment debate at this point, and I could blather on for a long time about CAFOs, or about we have a new noxious weed bill that's coming down the pike that really concerns me, but I'm gonna spend a few minutes on the water debate that's going on in Kansas. The governor has a 50-year water vision to handle it. And it's really about water supply. It's not, you know, it's very light on conservation or efficient use of water. 85% of all the water used in Kansas is for crop irrigation. I'll give you an idea. So the two tracks on this 50-year water vision, one is what are we gonna do about the Ogallala? We're draining the Ogallala. We have about 35,000 vested water rights that have been entered in by the state of Kansas with land holders. And it's pumping the Ogallala two or three times its rechargeable rate. We've used 40% of the Ogallala up to now, and K-State estimates that 70% of it will be gone by 2050. So we're headed for water courts, and we're headed for settlement disputes between neighbors and farmers, and whose pump is draining my pool of water to water my crop. So it's coming to the legislature whether they want it or not. The other track this 50-year vision's about is surface water and the water for eastern Kansas and the majority of the population. And we rely on 14 federal reservoirs as backup storage for the water to, for our municipalities. And Kansas has never been a great place to build reservoirs as flat as we are. And as long ago as they were built, we have a lot of siltation problems. And a lot of that goes with the monocropping and cropping patterns that Kansas, you know, and all Midwestern states have developed. But so how much are we willing to put on the table to dredge these reservoirs? Taxpayers are now, we've started the first one at John Redmond Reservoir, ponying up $20 million to start that process. And the reason Redmond is so important is that it's the backup cooling water system for the Wolf Creek Nuclear Power Plant. So, and it's one of the most silted in of the reservoirs. We have a state water plan. Gosh, that's a good thing to have. Started in 1989. It should be funded at $25 to $28 million a year at this point. With our budget deficits and our revenue crisis, we're funding it at $13 million. It's kind of a pittance when you think about them. So we're waiting for a blue ribbon task force to be formed. We thought it'd be formed by this fall and that they would come to the 2016 Kansas legislature with specific recommendations to what are we going to find the revenues and what are we going to do about it. Well, the task force hasn't gotten appointed yet. No recommendations are going to come in 2016. We did spend $300,000 on the feasibility of building an aqueduct, a 300-mile aqueduct from the Missouri River at White Cloud out to western Kansas, at a cost of probably $15 billion. So we'll have to figure out how to pay for that. On the agricultural scene, Greg and I have had, you know, been over there in battles about corporate agriculture in Kansas. Kansas is one of eight states that has some limitations on corporate agriculture. It's some, I want to emphasize. Basically says that if seaboard, and it's mostly on, and almost particularly solely on hogs, corporate swine, if seaboard wants to come in and build a facility themselves, then they've got to get a resolution passed in a county to be able to do that. And Craig could talk a long time about Greeley County and Seaboard and the abuses that have gone on there. Well, we don't have our limits on farmer-owned. So if Farmer Paul builds a 5,000-head hog CAFO, then these laws don't apply. We got a bill passed this last session, and we've established a Kansas local food and farm task force. It's seven members. They're spending 2015 to come together with a report that's coming back to the 2016 legislature to talk about food opportunities, and I can answer questions and thing. So I'm going to take my last minute to go to I want to end with some religious connections since I'm here in a church. You know, for many conservatives, government is the problem. That was Ronald Reagan's thing. For many conservatives, government is bad. But for a lot of conservatives in Kansas, government is evil. That it's private enterprise that's perfect and the free market. And it's an eternal truth. So I guess I wonder how Moses left this eternal truth off of the Ten Commandments. You know, one will worship the private market. I wonder why Jesus did not add this to one of his sayings, blessed are the peacemakers and blessed are the free marketers. The simple truth is that a democracy establishes the rules for the marketplace. And with Citizens United and unlimited corporate campaign cash, our democracy is truly endangered. So it's your and my participation in the electoral politics that is incredibly essential. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Now, would the ushers please take up the collection, and we'll now do some question and answers. Remember, one question per person until everybody has a chance, and no speeches. Paul is going to be available afterwards in the meeting room, and there you can make a speech. So I'll just hand it over to Paul.
I moved to Kansas City in 1972, and my children grew up here. Went through Kansas City Public Schools. One went to UMKC, one went to KU. And at the time they were growing up, the story that they would hear is that their friends were marrying, and when they first married, they would live in Missouri. But then when they started having children, then they were going to move over to Kansas and spend their lives there. And now what they're hearing, and one called and asked me about it, now as their friends are having children who are getting married and then having children, the word that they're hearing is, well, at first when they're married, they're going to live in Kansas, but then when they start having children, they're going to move over to Missouri. And they called me up and asked me, what's happened here? So can you make some comments about what's happening with movement back and forth between the two states?
Well, I have little clue about on the Missouri side, so I'll be very honest about how that plays against. But I try to sketch out in some of my remarks is that we've been under, we haven't kept up with the consumer price index for funding public education in Kansas, and it's showing in the quality and the types. And do you have arts programs, or do you have nurses in your schools, do you have counselors, or things are just getting sliced to deal with the budget. My sense in watching Kansas City News and trying to understand the mess that's going on in Missouri is I can't believe it's that much better. In Kansas, they tried to come with some equality. They tried to figure formulas that would put some balance between rural and urban areas, and the taxing power, a mill in Johnson County versus a mill in Montgomery County or wherever. It's incredibly different to what it raises. And states like Missouri, Texas, other places, it's more local property based, and they can fund better schools if you can talk to constituents in that local area. But then it gets, but I don't know how much Missouri's grappled with in a certain equality statewide.
Yeah, hi. I wondered, have you seen this film called Where the Buffaloed Roam?
I've not seen it. I've heard, I know what it's about.
And it's done by a high school kid in Lewisburg, Kansas, and it's all about the brown back budget. I just wondered if you
comments
about
people who've told me about it have just been incredibly impressed that it really encapsulated what some of the downsides of what's happening with the brown back's experiment.
You made a persuasive argument about how Koch brothers and the other large financiers are getting the Kansas government they're paying for. But to what extent are the residents of Kansas, the voters, getting the government that they want, as you've portrayed it? And if not, might there be some point at which they'll say, this is not what we thought we were voting for? Do you see that coming up? Or is there a common interest between the typical voter and the Koch financiers?
Well, one's got to wonder about, you know, what happened to the moderate Republicans, the Graves, the Kassebaums, the, you know, in 2014. And Brownback ended up winning Johnson County by, you know, which really wasn't expected. He only won by 44,000 out of 1 million votes statewide. When they flipped the state Senate in 2012 and drove out a lot of the moderate Republican senators, they did that with only 10,000 votes and a number of select primary votes that were funded by it. I don't know what the wake-up call is for Kansas right now. I struggle with that. The Docking Institute out of Fort Hays does a lot of polling on, you know, are you agreeing with what Brownback's doing? What are you thinking about some of these policies? And they're dreadful. I mean, Brownback's at 18% agreement for what he's doing. I mean, 2016, all 40 state senators, all 125 House members are up for election or re-election. And it's a pivotal election for Kansas. If they're worried about quality of life, if they're worried about holding on to something that's been special in our state, you know, since went forever, it's on the ballot. With who is coming back to the legislature, and how are we going to revisit and reformulate a fair and equitable tax plan for Kansas?
I happen to be a Kansas resident, and I'm happen to be lucky because my representative and my state senator both are moderate Republicans. And
good for you. You can sleep a little easier, baby.
Melissa Rooker is extremely active and very competent. My concern is that if we blow away all of the Republicans, we're going to sweep away some good people,
no,
too.
No, I didn't say that. What
no,
I said
I know,
was, you know.
Some people think that.
Well, that's unfortunate.
I have one other question that may stray a little bit, but it's about agriculture. How, for the future of agriculture in Kansas, how does the Land Institute fit into any of this? I mean, it's totally non-state and it's non-profit. I understand that, but I don't know a lot about it, but I'm from central Kansas originally, so could you comment on that?
I'll do it quickly. Actually, I grew up in McPherson, Kansas. So, and I met Wes and Dana shortly after they started the Land Institute, went to the first couple of prairie festivals. Wes has been on a cutting edge for decades, and what it's about is how to use the prairie as a template to produce grain crops or that, with a prairie that has constant plants, that has a mix of plants, holds the soil, needs less pesticides, fertilizers, whatever. So can we integrate the prairie model into growing wheat, growing sorghum, and they've continued to make progress with it, and Wes has found, you know, the funds to keep it going. I mean, he's well aware that it's a couple generations out probably still, you know, but he's not the quack or the crazy that he was 30 years ago, and that now people with cover crops, with, you know, intensive grazing, you know, extended grazing systems, you know, people are getting to understand what it means to keep plants on the soil, and then the carbon sequestration that goes with pulling carbon dioxide out of the air. I mean, agriculture could play a key part in reversing some of the damage we're doing with fossil fuels.
First, I have an obligation to mention that the forum committee is working on a forum that will deal especially with the education issues resulting from the things you discuss, probably in February, et cetera.
Great.
Over the decades, I've heard quite a few rumblings from the southwest part of Kansas about secession from the state. Can you say anything about what's happening in southwest Kansas? It's a long way off from here.
It is a long ways off. But actually, I don't think they're very eager to succeed because they would lose the golden Johnson County. Because Johnson County puts about a third of the tax revenue into this state. So a lot of southwestern county school districts, for example, are benefiting. I mean, they're getting far more in taxes than they're paying in, so, you know, as far as that goes. I mean, a lot of it has been brought on by the consolidation of agriculture in our state, and farmers have gotten much bigger. We've lost 90% of our dairies and 90% of our hog farms, and you know, we have 65,000 farms in Kansas, and 5,000 do about 75% of the farm sales. I mean, we're talking about southwestern or southeast, you know, that we need a more creative, more specialized cropping systems. You know, we need to work a plan out. I mean, we could bring winter squash in from southwestern Kansas. We can bring in things we need and aren't eating at this point. There would be some opportunities, but the food debate has not been much, you know, and with this food report that's coming in January, we're trying to spur on some of that discussion.
Well, I take some encouragement from what the Land Institute is doing, but given the facts you've recited of a blue ribbon commission to deal with water problems and the fact that by 2050, we will have used up 70% of the aquifer, are we going to have to wait till someone turns on a tap and nothing comes out before something really is done? Do you have any encouragement on when something might change?
I mean, Craig could talk a lot more eloquently about some of these details than I can. The fact that Ogallala is not one equal aquifer across the thing, so it really varies by different parts of it, you know. And where we put this hog farm in Greeley County that needs incredible amounts of water for 300,000 hogs, they don't have enough water. They're, you know, so there are parts of northwest Kansas that the tap's starting to go out, and that they're going down another 100 or, you know, 200 feet to get water. Mm-hmm. And some of this, I mean, a number of farmers are reaching their own limits, and it's not going to be equal across the thing, but and it's going to force them into dry land farming, and you know, there may be some more pasture, and gosh, we may put part of it back to the prairie, which we took it out of, but they can't ignore. I mean, it's a crisis that's a slow moving, and it's evolving, it's coming. So.
Okay, thanks a lot, Paul. Thank you very much. And I'd like to show our appreciation by handing you our U.S.-made mug, your very own UU4 mug.
Beautiful.
I hope you drink coffee.
I do drink coffee every morning.
All right, great, thanks. Next week will be Jolie Justice talking about reforming the criminal justice system. You are also invited to, immediately after the forum, we'll be going to the meeting room for those of you that would like to ask additional questions or make comments. So you're welcome to do that, or at 11:15, you're welcome to stay for our regular service. So thanks a lot for coming to the forum.